Hey, it's Bill DeYoung. Welcome again to the Catalyst Sessions. We're having a good time doing this. I hope you're enjoying it from your isolation. We're happy to join you from ours. I'm Bill DeYoung. We're keeping our arts community connected. Today, very, very special guest. Doesn't even live here anymore, but I mean, his name lives on and his reputation precedes him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There he is right now. The author of 7 books, winner of the Florida Folk Heritage Award and a Lifetime Writing Achievement Award. Probably the best-selling author ever to come out of St. Petersburg. Ray Arsenault may argue with that, but, you know, it's sixes and half dozens, you know. Our guest spent 38 years as a staff writer with the St. Petersburg / Tampa Bay Times. He is speaking to us from Waynesville, North Carolina tonight. Please say hello to Jeff Klinkenberg. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how are you, sir?
There you are. So what are you doing in, where's Waynesville? You know, it's like Wayne's World. Where's that?
Waynesville is in Western North Carolina. I'm 10 miles away. I live up in the mountains, right on the border of Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And so I live right on the edge of the wilderness. So Waynesville is about 10 miles to the south of me. And Waynesville is about 30 miles from Asheville, if you can situate yourself that way.
I just know it's beautiful country up there, and it's real different from Florida.
It is. And I'm here, you know, I've been coming up here since I was about 10 years old. And my parents used to come up here and camp when I was a kid. And then as the years went by, they would start to rent here for a couple weeks every summer. Uh-huh. And then when my kids were kids, I would do the same. It was always a good place in the summer, but I loved it. And my kids take their kids up here. But I guess about 6 or 7 years ago, my wife Susan and I decided to buy a place here. And we did. And we used it as a vacation home for a few years and rented it.
Yeah.
But about a year ago, we moved here for good. And I certainly haven't abandoned Florida. I get down there four or five times a year to do book talks, to see my family and to see lots of friends. And I'm still doing some talks for the Florida Humanities Council in different places in Florida. So Florida is in my blood, but so is this place, you know.
It's beautiful. But how do you deal with the winters, man? I mean, you know, doesn't snow like that in Florida.
Oh, son. I can tell you that this year they were saying, oh, it's been such a mild winter. But, you know, and I would step out on this deck where I'm sitting right now, and it'd be 8 degrees and snowing. And I'd say, oh, my God. But it's gotten... It's been below zero too when I've been here. So that's you know, talk about the shrinkage factor where
right.
So it's a little bit startling. It's beautiful though. But I was happy when it started to warm up a little bit. It's still in the 30s in the morning. But then it gets up into the 60s during the day and it's beautiful.
And you know what I feel like, Jeff? I feel like we're a couple of old guys talking about the weather, sitting on a park bench here. Let me turn the clock back a little and look at my professionally written notes, which we did about 5 minutes before we went live. Well, something you told me once about your boyhood in South Florida, I got to tell you, always resonated with me, that you would spend all day, you know, running around and exploring and chasing after reptiles, and your parents wouldn't miss you most of the day. I had my own version of that growing up in St. Petersburg. It was similar, not the same. There were still wild places right here in civilization. And I wondered if you think that's where your sense of like wonder and curiosity began. Like, what's out here?
Right, good question. I mean, that really is yes, it did. And my parents, my dad really liked the outdoors. He was a piano player from Chicago. Both of my parents were city people, but he fell in love with Florida right away. We lived in a house without air conditioning for 10 years. The first 10, actually more than that, the first 15 years in Florida.
No jealousy air windows, maybe.
Jealousy yeah. windows, you know. My mother, you know, you'd hear a shriek in the kitchen when she turned on the light because something, cockroaches were spilling out of the silverware drawer, right? So it was like, it was.
Those were the days.
The Niagara Falls of the kitchen. My mother hated Florida, but she was just a real, she was a great storyteller. You know, she had that Beatrice Mary Grace O'Donnell. She had that Irish thing going.
Oh, yeah.
And she would go down the street, come back. She'd be smoking that Pall Mall, be hanging there. And she'd say, let me tell you what I found out. And she'd spin these stories about the neighbors. So I got that from her and my yeah. love of the outdoors from my dad. And you're right. And it was Miami, not St. Pete, but Miami still had the wild places.
Yeah.
And, you know, we grew up at a time where, you know, there was no such thing, as far as I know, there were no helicopter parents, you know. My father would joke, here, I'm going to pack your lunch in a roadmap, you know. But
hey, Joe, can we bring up that first picture while Jeff is talking?
So anyway.
Keep talking. You know, maybe not. Keep, yeah.
So, I was, you know, down at the canal and under the bridge and doing all kinds of stuff that should have gotten me killed, you know.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's my dad. That's in Key. He had a summer gig in Key West when I was.
He was a piano player. Yeah.
He's a piano player. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a really good one.
What was his stage name?
Ernie Bergen.
Ernie Bergen.
Yeah.
And his hot and tots, man. I like
that. So in Chicago, he had a what he called an orchestra, which was usually four or five guys, playing a lot of big band and whatever. I still have his fake book. Do you know what a fake book is?
Oh, it's sure. A, yeah, yeah.
So
live and die by the fake book when you're a musician. Yes.
So this was a book, just to tell the audience.
Yeah.
It's a book that has, it has basically lyrics to all the popular songs and the chord changes. And so my dad could read music, but when he was playing nightclubs, you know, somebody would say, hey, can you play Satin Doll or whatever?
Yeah.
And he could turn the page and there would be the lyrics and you know, he could, his ear was so good, he could just play the melody and the all the chord changes and sing along. So I still have that fake book of his.
Oh, right? That's cool. I admire people who can do that.
Yeah.
You told me once that, and this, I'm disconnecting with the question I asked, that, you know, it's in the details that maybe you got that, you know, your sense of curiosity and your sense of, you know, I want to know more about this, you know, from your mother and from the shared experience there. But that kind of imbued who you became as a writer, you know, not just like a beat reporter, like I want to know more.
My mother thought everybody had a story. And so I grew up with that. And I still think it's true, you know. You know, I felt like I could talk to anybody. And there was something, and a lot of people, and you probably ran into this too, you'd say, hey, I'm so-and-so, and I want to do a talk. I'd like to do a story about you. And the person might say, well, really? I'm not that interesting.
Oh, yeah.
They were, sure. You know, once you... Okay. And so
everybody has a story, right? That's the thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with the stuff I wrote about, a lot of that, the beauty of that, the beautiful thing about it was that a lot of that stuff hadn't been written about, you know, it was just out there waiting to be explored. You know, there were some people that I admired as writers when I was a kid, down in Miami, but with a couple of exceptions, I mean, they didn't have, say, the skills to pull things off. So it was, you know, I used to I used to joke that I was like a blind dog in a smokehouse.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, a blind dog in a smokehouse can—it's wherever it's you know, it's lunging for food, it's going to get something tasty. And I felt like that a little bit, you know, that wherever I looked, there was something interesting. And again, a lot of those people didn't think what they were doing was extraordinary.
Well, also, but, you know, one of the, where it comes from too, is your ability to see the interesting thing in like the people who worked in a diner, you know, the mullet giggers, you know, all the right. incredible people you wrote about. I wanted to ask though, your first beat at the Times in 77 was as a sports writer, an outdoors writer.
I was the outdoors writer.
And yeah, okay. And I can imagine that got old after a while, having been in newspapers.
Well, I'll tell you what was interesting was before I did that, I was the National Football League writer. I was covering the Miami Dolphins when I was
in Miami. Yeah.
In Miami, during their Super Bowl years.
Yeah.
And I was really young to have that beat.
Yeah.
And that got really old for me after a while. I'd never traveled. So suddenly I'm traveling and, you know, I'm meeting, I'm staying at these fancy hotels all over the country, which I'd never done because grew up in a blue collar home. And, meeting these sports celebrities and stuff, but some of them were nice people. Some of them weren't.
Yeah.
And that started to get dull to me because I was starting to read like John McPhee and New Yorker and different writers, and they were like hanging out with people and they were doing real storytelling. And with covering the pro football, first of all, you didn't have much access to players. It might be 5 minutes, 10 minutes walking from one meeting as they walk from one meeting or in a locker room.
And they'll always tell you essentially the same things anyway.
Exactly. Every cliche.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I'm covering pro football and someone remembered that I'd been an outdoors guy when I was a kid and that during the off season, I used to like to write outdoor stories and someone offered me the chance to write outdoor stories. And I thought about it and outdoor stories weren't written well. They were, you know, me and Salty, you know, out in the,
he put his lure on. Yeah. I've read a few of those.
You bait the hook.
Yeah.
But I had like, by then I have John McPhee on my, you know, I see McPhee's writing these stories.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this might be a great opportunity to write real stories about real people who won't be looking at their watch after 5 minutes.
Right.
So I decided to do it. And I had friends who said, are you crazy? You're 22. You're covering professional football. There's no greater beat for a sports writer in Florida at that time. So I did that in Miami for three or four years. Not well. All my ambitions were, you know, I wrote some good stories, but they wanted like six stories a week back then, and you just couldn't write well. You know, you couldn't travel. You couldn't
crank them out. Yeah.
But Eugene Patterson, who was the editor of the St. Pete Times, and Hubert Mizell, who was the sports editor, they offered me this job where I would just have to write a couple of times a week. And I was going to get on the front page, you know, and I was going to have an artist work with me exclusively, a guy named Scott Eastand, you might remember. And I thought, wow, this would be great. So I did that for a couple of years at the St. Pete Times. And I enjoyed it, though then I started to feel like I've written this story before, you know, the Tarpon Roundup story, you know.
Oh, yeah, I was reading those today, you know, for this thing,
And I started to think, well, what do I like about writing about the outdoors? What could I do to sort of expand on it? And there was a guy at the Miami Herald who I really did admire, who was a wonderful writer for years. His name was Al Burt, B-U-R-T. And he used to write for Tropic Magazine, who wrote a column called Al Burt's Florida, and where he traveled around. He had some physical disabilities, which didn't allow him to like wade in swamps and stuff, but he was a wonderful interviewer. He was a front porch interviewer and a very elegant writer. And he was getting ready to retire. And, you know, I called him up and he was really encouraging. He encouraged me to kind of continue this kind of writing in Florida. The stuff that normally just falls through the cracks, you know.
You knew you were right, though. You knew that that was the thing. Yes. You know, and that counts for when you started switching gears at the Times, though. How did they react to it? You tell them about Albert. You tell them about, Ray Washington.
What happened was the Atlanta Constitution Journal, or the Atlanta Journal Constitution, AJC.
AJC.
Called me up and invited me up for a job interview. And they wanted me to be what they called the Georgia Rambler. And I was going to do the Albert job in Georgia.
With a banjo, right? Yeah.
And I was going to take it. I went up there three times.
You were already at the Times?
I was the outdoors writer at the Tampa Bay Times. It was Safety Times. And I went to Atlanta three times to talk about this possible job, and even looked at property. And Gene Patterson, the editor of the Times, said, "You can't." And he had worked there too. He'd won a Pulitzer there back in the '60s for his civil rights columns. He said,
"Yeah,
you just can't go. You know, you got to stay here, and we'll make it worth your while to do it. What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be the Florida Rambler."
With no banjo. What do you want to do? God, remember when people would say that?
Yeah. It was, you know, and it was, I did it a long time. I was never really, there were times, and, you know, you were in the business too, where you sort of get burned out. You have to reinvent yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Though you still have to keep writing stuff, but
you never stop.
But for the most part, it was just the most unbelievable gig, traveling from Key West to Pensacola, and I could write about anything, Bill. I could write about murder. I could write about moonshining. There was not a subject I couldn't write about. Going through the prism of Florida.
Did people ever turn you down? So, you know, you go past that, oh, I'm not that interesting thing, that sort of false modesty thing, and say, no, man, screw you, go away. I don't want to talk to you. How often did that happen?
You know, there were a couple times. The famous story, and you may remember this guy from growing up in St. Pete, but there used to be this guy who hung around the waterfront, who was over 7 feet tall.
I know this story. It's in one of your books.
It is.
Oh, tell us.
So I used to see him out there, and he'd have a shopping cart and a gig, and he'd be gigging mullet and sheep's head. And then he was selling his fish someplace.
Yeah.
And so I saw him one day and I didn't talk to him. And then I decided, well, gosh, I need to write about this guy. Yeah. And then I couldn't find him anymore. So I started asking around. And somebody would say, well, you know, he hangs around at Mastery's Bar. So I went to Mastery's Bar, and Lay Mastery was alive then. He said, oh, we call him Slim. I don't know what his real name is. And I had to throw him out of here because he pulled a knife on a customer or whatever.
And you still want to find the guy. Yeah.
So I have messages out there. So one night I'm out there, I drive out there, and there he is.
Yeah.
And I park, I got a Volkswagen van. I park my van there and sort of sidle up close to him where he's gigging. And I said, "Excuse me, my name is," and he says, "I know who you are. I'm not talking to you." I said, "Well, you know, here's what I want to do." And
he's hovering over you.
Oh my God. Yeah. And he said, "F off," you know?
Yeah.
And of course I'm looking at his fillet knife on his belt, and I decided, well, he's given me some good advice here, so I will. So, you know, years later, decades later, when the new pier was going to be built, I thought, you know what, maybe I'll write this now. And I assumed he was dead, but I really didn't know anything. And I started this search again. And it wasn't all that I worked on at the time, but every once in a while I would meet somebody, I would ask, and eventually I did find out who he was. And that story is in the book called Alligators and B-Flat. So he was my Moby Dick. He was the one who got away.
Never talked to you, though, after that. Was that the only encounter you ever had with the guy?
Yes, yeah. Were his only words to me. But so, just like everybody we've ever known, he was a complicated, tormented.
You got into his background, I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I found his sister and friends and whatever.
And that's in Alligators and B-Flat. Not to butter you up because you don't need it, but, you know, your gift, I always thought, was to take ordinary people doing ordinary things and just give it to us in an extraordinary way, you know, and even the most mundane. You actually, reading through your books, you wrote about a couple of people that I encountered over the years, and I would never have seen it. I would never have been able to dig for that story and been able to tell it in, you know, such an engaging way. You know what? Right now, because I'm looking at the time, I know what I want to do. I have another picture I want to bring up, and do this for me. If you just tell this story, if you don't mind, because I love this. Joe, can you do the Trooper Stone photo? Now, Jeff knows what it is. Do you know what? And it might be a little, I don't know.
Yeah, well, sure.
Joe's even there. Oh, you know, this usually means, there it is. Can you just take a minute and tell the story? Because I love this story. This is one of those serendipitous things that you've.
So for years, right? I mean, every time you went and pumped your gas, you would see this label on the gas pumps. And I would look at it, and that's a scary ass guy, right? And I'd see it. He was just part of the weekly landscape when you were filling your gassing up. So one day I'm up in the Florida Panhandle writing another story.
Yeah.
And it was late in the afternoon. I started to run short of gas. I was in the sticks. I started to worry. It was hot, but I turned off the air. I'm trying to conserve gas. And I basically rolled into this gas station it's called East Point. It's a little bit east of Apalachicola. It's a tiny town. So I pull up to the gas pumps and I'm filling up my car. And while I'm doing that, a highway patrolman pulls up on the gas pumps on the other side. And, you know, for some reason, I just like leaned over to look at him, and it was him. And I thought, holy, you know, as far as I knew, he was an actor. You know,
how could the guy in the picture?
Yeah. So he's in the picture.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, God. So naturally, I went over there and I just told him what I told you.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was a former Marine who ironed his uniform every day, his highway patrolman uniform every day.
Took it seriously.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And it was yes, sir. And no, sir. And I told
him. But he looked just like the picture, right? With the hat.
And I actually, thank God I had a camera, you know, to take the picture, because people wouldn't have believed me. And I said, you know, Trooper Stone, right? That's what his name was.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, Mr. Stone, where I come from in St. Petersburg, people deface your picture. You know, they, and I, you know, they, you know, they put it like a, an arrow. It says Hitler, you know, or I'm gay or something like that. So I told him
like
that.
Junior high school.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he said, I've heard that, sir, but you know, up here people are polite and this is a family plate. But anyway, he was he was delightful to talk to, because he was like so straight, you know. And so I wrote that, you know, I wrote it up just like we just talked about it.
I remember when you told me this story once, I thought it was so funny that I hadn't read it and I had to go back and find it. And it was totally worth it.
You know, I wrote lots of stories in my life. And like, that's one that people seem to remember.
How many stories you figure you wrote? How many of those real Florida columns you know?
God, that's a good question. You know, fewer as the years went by, you know, but back when I started, when you started, you know, you were expected to write 5 or 6 a week. You know, when
you cranked them out. I do that now for the same B Catalyst, don't I, Joe? Yes.
So, but anyway, I wrote a lot of them. And, you know, when I drop by the University of Florida and I do a talk, journalism talks, Mike Foley, who was the executive editor at the Times,
I remember Mike very well, sure.
Wants me to talk about Trooper Stone. And just the idea of paying attention. You have to pay attention to do this work well. You have to notice what's in front of you, and you have to notice, and you have to notice stuff that is out of place too. You know, what makes this unusual. You know, so he was certainly one of those. I mean, it was one of the, I knew I would never win the lottery, you know, after that, because I had my luck looking over there and seeing that guy.
Well, you know, your books and the columns, they're full of such extraordinary, just a lifetime of adventures. Was it 2014 when you left the Times?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, was there a period where you sort of said, damn, I'm going to miss that? Or were you like, okay,
oh yes,
let me do something else with my life?
I really enjoy talking to those people. And I did quite a bit of freelancing for 3 or 4 years after that. So I still got to travel a little bit, you know, drive around and meet people. But it was it was just a great gig. I really enjoyed talking to those people. And I enjoyed my readership too, because I would hear back from people, you know. And, you know, I knew people, I knew journalists, you know, my friend Howard Troxler, who was a great columnist, who finally decided to retire because he just couldn't stand the online commentary or the people who would call him who were just mean and hateful, you know. And I just rarely encountered that. Most of the people I met were really nice, you know. They were lovely folks, and I still, you know, up in North Carolina, there's a lot of people like that. And, you know, when I'm every once in a while I'll see somebody and I'll think, man, if I had a gig, I would write about that guy or that woman. Be,
you know, the North Carolina Rambler, right? You know, it's like, well, yeah.
There's a guy that I see a couple times a week if I go to town. He's dressed in black. He's in a wheelchair. He's got a pork pie hat on, you know, with the brim up.
I have to know.
And he's got one leg, and he's in this wheelchair, and he's going down the middle of roads where people are going by at 45 miles an hour. and they're on steep hills. And he's like going like this. He's going up these steep hills. And, you know, I wave to him. Sometimes he'll give me a nod or whatever. And then about a month ago, I ran into him in Publix. He was in Publix at the pharmacy, and he was getting some medicine. And he was younger than I thought, tattoos and piercings. And I just told him, man, you're quite an athlete, you know? And he just had kind of this vacant look in his eye. And I didn't say, where did you lose your leg? Did you lose your leg in battle? But I've been kicking myself since then, you know? So I look for him. And if I have that opportunity again, I'll ask him. And I may not write anything about him, but it's really cool when you, I used to love these stories that were just right in front of you, you know, but nobody wrote about them. Slim was one of them. that tower in Tampa, what is it called? It's not
Silver Tower.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the tower Bach. There.
Not Bach Tower.
The tower that's if you pass it when you're on.
That's on 27 or something.
On I-275 when you go through Tampa. It's near the zoo, and you see it on the. If you're going north, you see.
Oh,
it
the
on
tower the, that had like a big. Like Sulfur somebody Spring. Shot a cannonball at it or something. Yeah. Sulfur oh yeah, Spring. I remember that one.
You know, and years
what was
ago.
The deal with
it? You know, it was like Disney World there. That was part of this Disney World thing. But I wrote about it. But I like to write about things, people you see every day, but maybe they just you just take them for granted. And that guy who was dressed in black with one leg would be one of those people that, you know, I would write about. And I've seen a couple of those. You know, I've seen a couple people just when I'm driving around or on my bike. I think this would be interesting. He would be
once a storyteller, always a storyteller. You're not writing anymore now. You're just kind of kicking back and enjoying retirement. Well,
I burned out a little bit from the middle of 2018 to the middle of 2019 with my last book, Son of Real Florida.
Yeah,
I was going out there and promoting it, and so I did 50 talks. In a year from South Florida to Pensacola while I was sort of living up here. So I put 25,000 miles on my car and I enjoy talking, as you can see, but I just sort of I finally finished and I had, I was exhausted. And I was at this place where I wanted to be, but it took me a while to settle down. I mean, I went into projects, yard projects, you know, where I was, cause I live in the woods and there was a lot of stuff that never had been done.
Yeah.
And I kind of worked myself to exhaustion a little bit. And so I haven't done anything. However, I've been doing these outlines of short fictional stories that I would like to write based on growing up in South Florida when I did civil rights, the Cuban Missile Crisis, terrible racism, but wonderful people. And I'd just like to see what I could do with that, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So
fiction writing scares me. I haven't gone there yet because I'm afraid I'd really suck at it, you know. And my family or my friends will be going, yeah, Bill, that's really you know, and you know that reaction you get from people, yeah, real good.
Well, and some of them some of them are, you know, pretty excuse me, pretty black. Pretty dark.
That sounds really interesting.
But some of them would be kind of funny, you know, but So I've got those, and now I need to really get off my ass and do them, you know?
Well, let's get off this interview. You can go work on it, because we're actually just about out of time anyway. You got time to go work on it now. I was saying before, once a storyteller, always a storyteller. And I had this great thing where I was going to bring it around and say, you're just like the little kid looking for things under rocks while you're out in the woods and around Miami, you know. And boy, it was full circle from the beginning of the interview, you know.
And you know what? I still do that. I still kick rocks over, because I always think there's going to be, I don't think there's going to be any gold coins, but I always think, well, I'm going to see find a snake or a salamander or something like that. You know, you just want to see what's there, you know?
Well, that's so you. What a way to say goodbye. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Anytime, Bill. I always enjoy talking to you.
Oh, same here, my friend. Same here, my friend. And give our best to Susan. Sorry?
I'll do that. Next time I get down there, let's get together.
Absolutely. Let's raise one. Yeah. Thank you again. And thank you three times, I guess. Take care, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.